From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, Malaysia releases revised transcript of MH370 cockpit communications. U.S. ambassador's resignation could improve ties with India. And some good news for economies of Asia's developing nations. These stories and more on this Wednesday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. Malaysia has released a detailed transcript of the exchanges that took place between the cockpit crew of missing Flight 370 and air traffic controllers. The document reveals a more mundane final sign-off from the jet than authorities had described. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
Malaysian officials have released what they are calling the full transcript of Flight 370. The final words from the airliner to air traffic controllers were, "Good night, Malaysian 370. Earlier, Malaysian authorities had said the critical last communication was a more informal and uncharacteristic, "All right, good night." Malaysian officials say they are now uncertain whether the final phrase was uttered by the pilot or co-pilot, after previously saying the co-pilot likely made the final transmission. They say the transcript was initially held as part of the police investigation, but are giving no other reason for the delay in releasing it. The communications from the plane's cockpit to ground controllers have been under scrutiny for clues related to the plane's disappearance. So far, investigators searching the crew's backgrounds have found nothing to explain the plane's long, silent flight to a remote part of the Indian Ocean. The Malaysia Airlines flight went missing on March 8th with 239 people on board. The Director General of Malaysia's Civil Aviation Department on Tuesday spoke at the annual conference of the Trade Association for the World's Airlines, the International Air Transport Association. During his speech in Kuala Lumpur, Azharuddin Abdul Rahman gave details related to the ongoing search operations, but halted his remarks when he heard cameras clicking in the audience.
"The last download of the aircraft was at 1:07 in the morning, as it passed through the peninsula of Malaysia. The next download supposed to be at 1:37, half an hour later. I'm sorry, is there any media here? Can I ask the media to stay out, please?"
Tony Tyler, the Director General of the IATA, told delegates he understands global puzzlement about how the airliner could have vanished without finding any physical evidence after more than 3 weeks of searching.
"And in a world where our every move seems to be tracked, there is disbelief that an aircraft could simply disappear and that the black box is so difficult to recover. An Air France 447 brought similar issues to light a few years ago, and some progress was made. But that must now be accelerated. We cannot let another aircraft simply disappear."
But time is running out. Authorities say the batteries in the black box will lose power about 30 days after the crash. Andrew Herdman, Director General of the Association of Asia-Pacific Airlines, says even if the black box is not found before it stops transmitting, the search will likely continue.
"The technologies may change, but I think you'll still see a commitment to trying to find the wreckage. Not least, of course, we owe it to the families, but it's wanting to know."
Family members of the flight's Chinese passengers have directed their anger at Malaysian government officials. China's government and media have also criticized the handling of the crisis in Kuala Lumpur as clumsy. The Malaysian authorities say they are doing their best to solve the mystery. A multinational search currently includes at least 10 planes and 9 ships in the southern Indian Ocean, about 1,800 kilometers off Australia's west coast. An Australian military vessel carrying an underwater drone and a sophisticated American device that can listen for signals from the airplane's black box is now poised to join the search. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Higher education is becoming more accessible worldwide thanks to the Internet. We'll get a lesson on the digital classroom expansion coming up later on Daybreak Asia. In China, authorities have charged a former senior military official with corruption. Prosecutors allege that by abusing his power within the military, he amassed billions of dollars, speculated in real estate, and gathered a huge collection of gold and luxury goods. Rebecca Valley has more from Hong Kong on what the case means for President Xi Jinping's anti-corruption drive.
The secretive investigation that eventually took down People's Liberation Army Lieutenant General Gu Junshan lasted more than 2 years. Along the way, Chinese news media offered fragmented and unofficial reports about what investigators were finding. Billions of dollars in illicit transactions, golden statues and expensive liquor hidden in tunnels under his mansion. Now, the case of Gu Junshan, once the deputy chief of the PLA's General Logistics Department, has been transferred to a military court. He is charged with corruption, embezzlement, misuse of state funds, and abuse of power. Although the probe against Gu started under former President Hu Jintao's leadership, analysts say his public indictment was a direct result of Xi Jinping's drive to root out corruption. He Jiahong, a professor of law at Renmin University in Beijing, says that the high-profile nature of the case resonates in China, where the military forces inhabit a self-governing and opaque kingdom, rarely the subject of scrutiny.
This just illustrates the willingness of the new leadership to fight corruption, to spare no efforts to fight it to the end.
When state media confirmed Gu's indictment on Monday, they focused on the negative consequences of corruption within the military. A commentary on the official People's Daily said that scum like Gu Junshan has shamed a body as glorious as the PLA. Earlier this year, Chinese magazine Caixin reported that Gu had managed to profit from moving between the controlled and free markets. He would use his post to flip land owned by the military for fat profit, Caixin found. The deals allegedly included prime real estate in Beijing, Shanghai, as well as land in his hometown in Henan province. Kerry Brown is a professor of Chinese studies at the University of Sydney. He says that Gu's offenses are a byproduct of China's unregulated economic growth, which has favored those well-connected to power.
I mean, it would be very strange that such a large and such a prominent group didn't also like state-owned enterprises and like people in politics and other areas of society get involved in this cramming money when they can get it, basically because it's there. And there's no moral or regulatory sort of restraint on them.
The larger goal of the anti-graft campaign, analysts say, is to try changing how power is exercised in China and remove the most blatant cases of tutelage and abuses. Gu is among the most senior officials formally targeted in Xi Jinping's crackdown against corruption. Rebecca Valley in Hong Kong for VOA.
Often with change comes opportunity. The resignation of the U.S. ambassador to India could pave the way for improved ties with India. Anjana Pisricha reports from New Delhi that observers hope the departure of veteran diplomat Nancy Powell will reset ties that have been rocky since the arrest of an Indian diplomat in New York.
The resignation of U.S. ambassador to India, Nancy Powell, came as no surprise in New Delhi. Reports about her imminent exit had swirled in the Indian capital for weeks, following a rough patch in ties between the two countries. In Washington Monday, U.S. State Department spokesperson Mari Harf denied reports that Powell's resignation is linked to a recent diplomatic spat. She says Powell is retiring after a distinguished career.
It is in no way related to any tension, any recent situations. There's no big behind-the-scenes story here.
In New Delhi, however, analysts saw it as a move by Washington to wipe the slate clean on the ugly row over the arrest and strip search of an Indian diplomat in New York. They say it also sets the stage for doing business with the new Indian government, which will be in place by end of May. The Indian diplomat has returned to India, but her arrest last December on charges of underpaying her nanny has not been forgotten in Delhi. However, the bigger problem looming in bilateral ties is the U.S. approach so far to the prime ministerial candidate of the opposition Bharatiya Janata Party, Narendra Modi. According to polls, he could win enough votes to form a new government after elections conclude in mid-May. It was during Ambassador Powell's tenure that Modi emerged on the national political stage and became a serious challenger to the Congress-led government. Modi had been barred from traveling to the US and several Western countries for not doing enough to stop the 2002 religious riots that killed 1,000 people, mostly Muslims, in his Gujarat state. But several European countries built diplomatic bridges with him last year. Ambassador Pavel held a first meeting with Modi only 6 weeks ago. Analysts in New Delhi describe her move as too little, too late. Chairman of the Center for U.S. and Latin American Studies at New Delhi's Jawaharlal Nehru University, Chintamani Mahapatra, says Washington has been slow in reaching out to Modi.
There are certain issues which could have been handled in a slightly better way. 2005 was the year when he was denied the visa. This is 2014. Almost 8 years plus have passed, and no serious steps has been taken yet, although Ambassador Pavel met him. This is not the language if they really want to reset the button. That is one of the reasons why I think Washington is making subtle moves and try to have a new kind of interaction with potentially a new government in Delhi.
Pavel will leave her post by the end of May. Observers in New Delhi hope that the new ambassador will be a political heavyweight and not a career diplomat like her. Other observers say diplomatic and trade tensions during Pavel's tenure escalated following a period of drift in ties between the two countries as both the Obama administration and the Indian government failed to tap the relationship's potential. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Stop by our program page at voanews.com/daybreakasia for more on this and the day's other top stories, and you can take part in our weekly poll question. We also feature our stories on Facebook and via Twitter. You can follow me at VOA Stevenson. You may also take Daybreak Asia wherever you go as a podcast, or if you have one, you can listen via smartphone. Of course, we have a soft spot for all of our radio listeners carrying on a proud tradition of over 70 years. Thank you for tuning in. The Asian Development Bank forecasts that growth in the Asia-Pacific region's 45 developing economies will edge higher over the next 2 years, while China's, the world's second largest, will cool as it reins in a lending boom and transitions from an export-driven model to one focused on domestic consumption. The bank says developing Asian economies are expected to expand 6.2% this year. That's up from 6.1% last year and grow at a 6.4 pace in 2015. While China grew at 7.7% last year, it will expand at 7.5% this year and expected to be 7.4% in 2015. Meanwhile, Japanese consumers are coping with a rise in its consumption tax, which went into effect Tuesday as the government of Prime Minister Shinzo Abe tries to restrain its massive public debt of about $10 trillion, nearly 250% of its gross domestic product. The tax went from 5 to 8% and may rise to 10% in October 2015. At the same time, Japan's central bank says its quarterly Tonkin survey of business confidence soared to a six-year high in the first quarter of this year. Senior J.P. Morgan economist Masamichi Adachi in Tokyo told VOA's Victor Beatty the consumption tax hike is not the same as when that same tax was boosted from 3 to 5% in 1997.
That time, we had the Asian financial crisis, and also we had Japan's own financial crisis at the end of the year that made the economy dip into the recession, deep recession in 1998. But this time, our financial sector is very healthy, and we don't think that the Asian or any big financial crisis is coming in the near future. So external factors probably not so bad as in the case of 1997. We have to mention that our fiscal situation is so bad that we need to do something. And this tax hike is a sort of first step to make the fiscal situation more better shape rather than just let it leave as it is.
Are consumers just going to close their wallets and sit this out?
I think in the short term, yes, because many consumers rush into the stores to buy the goods, I mean, durable goods, or even non-durable goods like food, I mean, canned food or tissue papers, that means they have much storage at home and they don't have to buy in the near term. So second quarter, I mean, between April and June, we have to expect a big plunge of the consumption.
What does this tax cover? Every item that is purchased by consumers?
Basically, yes, but in terms of the CPI basket, the consumer price index basket, 70% of the items are taxed. But some services like education fees, that's exempt from tax.
Well, this is not the only hike. This tax is eventually going to go to 10%?
Yes, the government is scheduling to raise from current 8% to 10% in October next year. But the Prime Minister Abe hasn't determined it yet because he wants to see the development of the economy and he wants to decide a final decision at the end of the year.
What is this going to do to growth?
The growth is always coming from the private sector eventually. And the private sector means in this year, we expect the capital expenditure, business investment, and also exports will pick up. And that will offset the weakness of the consumption. That's what we're expecting. And also, government has already prepared the fiscal stimulus. That's probably ease the pains of the drag from tax hike.
There was a spike in business confidence, which soared to a more than six-year high. That was released. What does that all mean?
That means the overall situation of the economy is very good at the moment before the tax hike. And because, as I said, many consumers front-loaded their consumption. And also, business sector as a whole felt that this is a good timing to sell more goods and services because the consumer's confidence was strong. Therefore, business felt a very good performance in the fiscal year 2013.
Japan's economy grew 1.5% in 2013, the first year under Prime Minister Abe's economic plan of easy monetary policy and fiscal stimulus known widely as Abenomics. Adachi forecasts growth of about 1% this year as the effect of the tax hike kicks in. Dramatically expanding the quality and reach of education has been an announced priority of the U.S. government. Among the elements of the U.S. Department of Education has identified is the expansion of what are called Open Educational Resources, or OERs. One of those resources is MOOCs, another acronym defined as Massive Open Online Courses. These internet-based free courses started in the United States in 2001 and are now spreading worldwide. Daybreak Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Hal Plotkin, a senior policy advisor at the U.S. Department of Education. Plotkin has been in the forefront of advancing the use of open educational resources, and he spoke about the recent and rapid expansion of MOOCs in China.
You might be surprised to know that Chinese students are already using a lot of these materials and are already impacted by it now, whether they realize it or not. I met recently with the president of China's recently renamed Open University. He has a little over 5 million students who are in degree-granting programs, and a lot of the curriculum that they're using is curriculum that was translated from open educational resources that were produced here in the United States, principally at MIT. China has a very successful program that goes by the acronym OOPS, O-O-O-P-S. I don't remember what the Chinese translation of it is. But what they did with support from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation is they took all of the open educational resources, including the MOOC-like courses that MIT had offered through its Open Courseware Consortium, and they recruited a network of expat bilingual English-speaking, Chinese-speaking individuals who then translated all of those resources into Mandarin and made them available for use within China. So if you attend a technical college or university in China today, the likelihood is that you're using at least some of the open educational resources that were originally produced by institutions here in the United States. In addition, last time I checked, several dozen Chinese colleges and universities in China are also participating in something called the Open Courseware Consortium, which is a voluntary association of colleges and universities who have agreed to collaborate across borders and cultures on the shared production, continuous improvement of digital learning resources. So many Chinese colleges and universities, much to our delight here in the United States and to the delight of American higher education academic institutions, are already participating in this ecosystem, not only as consumers of open educational resources, but also as producers and improvers of open educational resources. And we're really grateful for the Chinese contribution to the shared academic ecosystem.
And there apparently is a profit motive in this as well, as far as overseas is concerned, which you explained before, is that correct?
Well, in some cases, people can take these materials and fashion them into things that they can either sell or that support sales food chains, if you will, in different industries. But I think the primary use of these digital resources in China is much like it is here, which is that the resources are being made available for free or at a very low-cost basis in order to accommodate the massive demand and the massive surge in demographics, particularly at college-age populations around the world, that can't be accommodated by bricks-and-mortar institutions. My friend Sir John Daniel at the Commonwealth of Learning has calculated that the demographic bulge, you know, we've got an enormous number of young people who will be coming of college age in the next 10 years or so around the world. And he's calculated that in order to accommodate all of the college age students around the world who will be ready and desirous of a college education 10 years from now, when that demographic bulge hits at the peak of the curve, we would have to build three new colleges and universities that serve 30,000 students each every week for the next 10 years. And I don't know about you, but I haven't built a 30,000 student college this week. And so, and we're not keeping up with the demand. And the projected demand is going to far out eclipse the current demand. So what we're seeing in countries like China and India, which is also turning very dramatically and quickly to open educational resources through the Indira Gandhi Open University, which is similar to the Open University in China, is the recognition that the only way to meet this burgeoning need is to change the delivery system for higher education so that we can use these digital resources to their maximum impact.
Is the quality of education equal to what's being delivered in the brick-and-mortar universities?
Well, now, we've done some studies about that, and many others have. And the answer to that is a firm yes and no. In some cases, yes. For example, the very sophisticated cognitive tutors that have been developed by Carnegie Mellon University's Open Learning Institute, which use recursive feedback loops. This is a relatively new technology whose power is astonishing. And what these are learning systems, digital learning systems that get smarter the more students use them. Others are worse. Others are little more than a crummy video camera being held by somebody with a shaky hand in the back of a room. And, you know, without the kind of scaffolding and support that students need. And in those cases, we see very, very high failure rates. So that's why I said it's kind of like asking whether the automobile is going to have a future in 1905 or 1910. You know, there were some automakers back then who we've never heard of since. And others, of course, have come to dominate the world.
Hal Plotkin, Senior Policy Advisor at the U.S. Department of Education, speaking with Daybreak Asia's Ira Melman. As Plotkin mentioned, the use of open educational resources is controversial. Many questions about its efficacy remain unanswered. In the coming weeks, we here at Daybreak Asia will further examine what's being viewed by many as the wave of the future in the effort to educate the ever-expanding numbers of students seeking higher education, as well as those who doubt the ability of OERs to accomplish that goal. Successfully accomplishing the goal of bringing you the latest world news is Steve Norman. He's next with International Edition. Please stay tuned. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.